Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Well, welcome into the Storycraft Cafe. I am your host, Hank Garner, and today I am super excited to have Claire McHugh on the show with us. I got to chat with Claire about 2.5 or 3 years ago when her first book came out, and today we are here to talk about The Romanov Brides. Her brand new novel comes out in just a couple of weeks from now. I haven't done the exact math. I think it's 2 weeks from today, isn't it, Claire? Today's Tuesday.
Yes, it's exactly
book
two
releases
days,
are two usually weeks. Two. Yeah, The Romanov Brides, a novel of the last Tsarina and her sisters. What an epic! And I know that word gets overused today, but what an epic adventure we go on with this book, Claire. What an amazing accomplishment! I absolutely loved it from the first chapter. This is one of those stories that you just fall into and you don't want to crawl out of. And I absolutely loved it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Hank. And thank you for your enthusiasm about this, my sophomore effort.
Well, your first book, and I'm blanking on the title, but it's
called A Most English Princess.
A Most English Princess. Thank you. Of particular interest as English history is, in this kind of strange way to Americans, where a lot of us feel like we're rooted, because a lot of us have English heritage, if we go back several centuries, we feel a strange connection to our past, but yet we are, kind of the outcast cousins that live across the pond. There's this fascination. Well, also with some interesting news that's happened over the last couple of years, a lot of us are turning our gaze toward Russia and, the interesting history that is kind of wrapped around Russia. And this is such a timely novel. And I know that this novel, it's so interesting to see when a book comes out and it's so timely and you really get to peel back the layers and see things that are similar to what's happening in the world today.
Yes.
And you just know that there was no way you could have predicted this, So how has life been from the first novel releasing to now?
Well, I was very gratified that the first novel, which really came out of a very, very eccentric interest of mine, which was the role that the British royal family played in the unification, the original unification of Germany, which is a really academic subject, right? And I wrote my novel about Vicky, Queen Victoria's daughter, best known really in the Western world as the mother of the Kaiser. I wrote about her efforts to make Germany in the 1870s and 80s be like Britain, a very benign and constitutional monarchy. And she went head to head with Bismarck, this young princess. She lost. Bismarck won. And the nature of the unification of Germany the first time was quite militaristic. And we saw how that the ramifications of that in the 20th century. So my first book was, it was pretty historical for a historical novel, and it did quite well. But I also wanted to tell a story the next time that stayed true to my interest in European history of the last years of the 19th century and the early years of the 20th century. That's my period. I wanted to stay true and go back to that period and to the extended family of Queen Victoria, but I wanted to tell a more romantic story. People like romance. I like romance. So I landed upon the idea of doing a novel about the princesses of Hesse. Alexandra, Alex, as she was called in the family, is the best known because she's the last Tsarina. And she was the one who was killed with her husband, Nikki, in the basement in Ekaterinburg. But how did their story start? I thought that people know a lot about how it ended, but not the romantic way it started. And right. The more I looked into it, the more I saw that there were parallels with my first book. This is a personal story that also has huge political implications and reverberates right down to the current day. So sure. That turns out to be my thing. So I did it again.
I meant to ask you a question a minute ago, and I'm going to go ahead and ask that to you now, but we got so excited talking about the new book. Have you ever, and just to kind of recap what we talked about last time, you worked in journalism and in magazine editing and this whole world before tackling fiction. And in your previous work or in your novelist work, have you ever been given a piece of advice that you look back on and say, oh, that was such a jewel of advice that I hold on to and it has served me well? Or have you been given a piece of advice that was so terrible, you're just happy to this day that you didn't take it or regret taking?
That's a terrific question, Hank. My new life as a novelist does have echoes in my old world of being a newspaper reporter, a magazine writer, and then an editor. And I had an editor when I was a young woman, 28 or 29, a really clever man called John Halpern. And he was one of my editors at a publication called the New York Observer, a newspaper. And I told John one day how I was in despair because I was never going to be a great writer. And all my efforts would be for nothing. It was a bad day. He said to me, oh, no. The most important thing about becoming a good writer is really wanting to be good. That is 90% of it. Once you've decided, oh, I want to be good, then you can get on with it. But if it's not something that you're really passionate about, it's really hard to turn up at the desk every day. And he inspired me to be a better magazine and newspaper writer. And he's died now. I remember him when I sit down and I look at what I wrote yesterday and said, not very good. And I think, no. I want to be better. I want to be good. I want to make this better. So let's get on with it. And that kind of that framework really works for me. I also think I have to work like lots of other people with a piece of advice that my mother gave me, which is comparisons are invidious. If you compare yourself to what happens, how other people's careers go and what other people write, and what kind of success they get, this is a formula for discouragement and a distraction. Writing is something that the person you're competing against is yourself. And compare your work to what you did previously. Borrow from other people. See why their work is popular, why people like it. See what you can steal. And then do it your own way. Take what they've done and put your own twist on it. So those two pieces of advice are fantastic. If I thought about bad advice, it would be the devil on my shoulder sometimes that says, this is a waste of time. Don't listen to that devil if you're committed to doing to finishing books.
Right. That is fantastic advice that you talked about there in the first part of your answer, which kind of brings me to maybe a sort of niggling esoteric question. But do you believe that writers are born with a storytelling gene or a gift? Or do you think that writing is something that is earned, that is a learned skill? And maybe like some people who are natural musicians who can play by ear and just hear a melody and can reproduce it. And compared with other people that have to study and really learn the ins and outs of music, do you feel like writing is, where do you think it falls on that spectrum?
I think some people are very good at it naturally.
Yeah.
But most people, and I include myself there, have to work very hard to get better. Again, it starts with a desire to do well and also to have been well taught by people. It helps to be well taught by people who are good critics of literature. I think an excellent education, which I fear lots of people don't get anymore, 4 years of high school English, really helps, is the foundation for good writing, and then lots of practice. But like everything, you know, like acting, like music, like cooking, some people just have this kind of natural knack for it. Right. But most people who really want to write well can get better and get to a pretty good level.
Gotcha. You said that earlier that kind of your wheelhouse, your preferred place to write about is, or time is late 19th century, early 20th century. That time period is so replete with, from societal upheavals to political changes, and so much of Europe was shuffled around and shifted. In America, we had the Industrial Revolution that was kicking off and changing the lives of nearly everyone in the population as a result. As a result of that, political changes and that our whole world was just reshaped by so many things in that, 50 year period, if you want to kind of block that off or whatever. What is it about that time period that fascinates you? Because we have so many stories that are beloved that come from that time period. It seems to be so rich and so many intriguing things come out of that time. What is it for you that, gets the creative wheels turning?
I think for me, there are several different things. It is the rise of the modern nation state. We see Germany and Italy coming together as nations. We see the United States really coming on the world stage, as you say, after the Civil War, the Industrial Revolution, the rise in women's rights, and it's the dawn of modernity. I think that's what I like about it, and also. Many of the stories that happen in the 20th century get their start then. I think it's an accessible time. There's a lot to read about it. I don't know if I could really write about the Tudors. It's so long ago, and we don't have the kind of as much primary sources as we have in the late 19th century and early 20th century. But having said that, Hank, now I'm working on another novel now about the 70s and 80s, because I think of the 20th century, I wanted to write a novel that was closer to my own time, and it's set in the United States. But my historical novels, I think, will always be I'm going to continue to write a set of historical novels about the family of Queen Victoria and the reverberations that went out from those those nine children and who they married and what happened to them. So there's a lot more to say. But in the meantime, I'm also plowing another field as well. But it's the early modern quality of those years that really interests me.
Gotcha. There was an interview a week or two ago where someone interviewed Vladimir Putin, and it's been all over YouTube. If you would have to try very hard to avoid this conversation. And one part of it, he gives the interviewer a history lesson on the vast history of Russia and the Russian people. And it's very fascinating to see how he kind of counted back the clock. And I guess his point was to show that Russia had been here a lot longer than most people have a tolerance for. That history is very rich. We being at the vantage point where we are, where a lot of us lived through the existence of the Soviet Union, and we don't really know a lot of that Russian history and this very old society that had been there for so long before the 20th century version. And so when we think of Russia, we think of the Soviet Union because that's what we know about. What kind of things when you, and I know that you do vast amounts of research and really get into the time period and get into the society so that you can accurately tell about it. But what were some things about this interesting society that you found fascinating?
Well, as you pointed out at the beginning, Hank, you know, there are weird, odd echoes in my novel to the modern day situation with the West versus Russia, Putin's mm-hmm. Russia. Russia has always been, you know, a vast place and a place that's not truly European. It's on the border, you know, it's on the border of Europe and Asia. It straddles the two continents. It's a place apart.
Yeah, you hear people say, is Russia east or is it west? Like they've always had this identity. I don't want to say crisis, but they don't feel like they fit in either place, it seems like.
No, that's exactly right. And it has ever been thus, you know, for 300 years as the West, and I include the Americans in that we are an extension really of the Anglo Western culture. We have all had to confront the otherness that is Russia. But it's also worth noting that Russia is a magnificent civilization, you know, with its own very amazing literary, musical, ballet history, and also, of course, the religion, which is striking in its ornateness and the depth of faith that it inspires in its followers. However, Russia's political development has always been on a different path than the West. You right. can see that Germany and Italy and France and Britain and, you know, even now some of the Eastern European countries are moving in the same direction. But Russia has never done that. It's always been a place. And even the dissidents of the current era bewail the fact that it's not been a place where freedom has flourished. And even Russians have felt the urge toward freedom. That has not been the highest attribute of public life. It's a great, great tragedy what's going on in Russia now. I think we all can agree. But the funny thing is that Putin harks back to the czars, and he self-consciously says that he is a new kind of czar. They would be horrified, the czars themselves, to think that this man. But there are things in common. He is an authoritarian. They were authoritarians. He has early in his career tried to resuscitate their reputations. You know, the bodies now of the Romanov family have been completely exhumed and examined and reburied, and they're not saints or demi-saints in the church. And yet the issues and the challenges and the drama that is Russia still exists for us, as it did for these German princesses who are thinking, do I dare marry into this family? Do I embrace what is a different world than certainly England, where they grew up in part with their grandmother, Queen Victoria, and Germany too.
One thing that's fascinating about reading in this time period and about royal families is such a foreign concept to us that these political marriages and a family from this country marries into a family over here. And that is such a foreign concept, you know, not only to our 21st century minds, but maybe in the television age, it doesn't seem to be a necessity today the way it was then. What were some of the things that surprised you about this convention that was so adhered to for so long we just can't wrap our heads around it, around the
no,
way that
we can't. And these women, the woman I wrote, Vicky, who I wrote about my first book, and Ella and Alex, who are her nieces, are essentially our great grandparents, grandmother's ages. And they lived in this caste, in this special group of royal families. And from an early age, they realized that they that the circle in which they could marry was very, very limited. And for the most part, they accepted this completely. They believed themselves to be of a special kind of blood. It's one of the ironies, of course, of my book that the blood disease, hemophilia, is also part of their blood, if you broaden the definition. I am interested in how women make decisions, especially when they have very limited agency. You know, a lot of historical fiction, which is less historical than mine, the women are triumphant, really. They, you know, they battle against the odds and they come out on top in some ways. Alex and Ella Hesse didn't. That's not the trajectory that they could follow. They are not American women in which, you know, these ideas of self actualization are so high. But they did have a decision about who they were going to marry within this cast of their extended family, essentially. And I was fascinated that they really did choose for themselves, and that on the that pivoting on their choice turned out to be a lot of history that had a great, consequences for the whole world. So on the one hand, princesses are, you know, looked up at, oh, what a wonderful life to be a royal princess. On the other hand, they were had very constricted choices. Mm-hmm. But the choices that they did make are came from their heart. And yet the consequences of those choices had hard, cold political realities attached to them, and consequences that came out of those decisions. That conflict between the spiritual and the earthly and political outcomes really interested me. And I thought other people would be interested. You know, one of the things when you write historical fiction, you want people to be interested. And sometimes when they have a little bit of knowledge already about these characters, they're like, how did Alexandra end up married to Nikki? It's an entry point. And then once you've lured them in with your entry point, you can tell them the story.
Right. If you're not familiar with the history of this actual occurrence, the subtitle of your book, A Novel of the Last Tsarina and Her Sisters, should give you a clue that this doesn't end well. But like unlike so many tellings of this story, you don't focus on the horrific end to all this, but you really spend a great deal of care and time in showing us how this all got started and what the realities of life were for these women and for everyone, you know, surrounding them. How did you choose the kind of window that you gave us to look into this time period and these people? And what were some of the choices that you had to make on, you know, what part of the story to tell and how to tell the story?
That's such a good question. And it really comes to the heart of, you know, constructing a good historical novel, because the thing about a historical novel about the 19th, you know, last years of the 19th century, there's a lot of material. There's a lot of ways the story could go. There are a lot of perspectives you could choose. And the hardest part of this book, I knew the arc of the story. I knew what I wanted to, where I wanted to land the characters at the end, but I wasn't sure about the path to get them there and how that the reader wouldn't be overwhelmed by information, that the reader would feel entertained at every stage. I was inspired, strangely enough, by Little Women. As you know, a book about four sisters. Sure. This too is a book about four sisters. They're called Victoria, Ella, Irene, and Alex. And they each have personalities the way the girls in Alcott's very famous and beloved novel have. So the thing that distinguished the Alcott characters from the princesses of Hesse was that the princesses of Hesse had no mother. So without the mother, Princess Alice, she died when they were 15, 14, 11, and 6. Without them, they were left to make to their own devices a lot. Their father was very feckless. So this suggested to me that the opening chapter should be the death of the mother, because that's the point of change, right? When does this really kick off, the story of these four sisters? When did they when was the starting point for the life that they lived? And it was, very sadly, the death of the mother. And then I really kept to Alex and Ella's points of view mostly because they are the Romanov brides. They're the two people, the two of the four who married into the Romanov family. But the eldest sister, who's called Victoria, is also very important. And people should know, is a very significant person also in British history. She is King Charles's great grandmother. She's a very practical, very assertive, the cleverest of the four of them. And she set the pattern in the family in that she married for love her cousin, Prince Louis of Mountbatten, called Battenberg at that time. It's no coincidence that Prince William's son is called Louis. The family really began with the marriage of Victoria and Prince Louis of Battenberg. Their grandson is Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, and of course their great grandson is the current king. This is an important and when they exhumed the body of the last Tsarina, they asked the Duke of Edinburgh for his DNA so they could be certain that this body was his great aunt Alexandra. I framed it as a story of four sisters. I usually kept to the point of view of Ella or Alex. But then occasionally, as you saw in the novel, I put in a chapter from other people so that the reader could experience what other people experienced when they met Ella or Alexandra. And one of them is Nikki's mistress, the dancer Matilda Krasinka. And another one is a friend of Nikki's who really had doubts about the fitness of Alexandra to be the Tsarina at the time of their courtship. But by keeping the novel to essentially 18 episodes, I could move people through the 15 years and all the conflicts that were involved to getting the two women married in a sprightly, but I hope entertaining way.
Historical fiction is such an intriguing genre because you know, you would hope that one of the purposes of historical fiction would be to tell an historically accurate story. But with the writer taking some liberties to fill in some of the gray areas or some things that were missing, but do it in a way that was consistent with what actually happened in history. I would think that would be a very difficult line to walk sometimes as an author. And granted, with this time period, if you do some digging, there's a lot of information there that can be found. But then your job as a novelist is to make that information interesting and readable. And to me, that it just seems like such a tightrope to walk between being a novelist and being true and consistent with the actual history. What's that like to try to have a foot in each world?
I think it's very important to think of yourself as a writer of historical fiction of doing two things. You are constrained by where your characters were and what they were doing at any one time. I think it's a sin against historical fiction to put people in a place they weren't, or have them meet people they never met, or speak in modern lingo, or even think in a way that it's a modern mindset. Those are the constraints. But the great thing, Hank, is a lot of things are taken care of. You know where this story happened. You know essentially how it ends. You know who's involved. And so the guidelines, the constraints can also be scaffolding. And it's the novelist's job to pick the scenes. In that way, also, I think good hysterical fiction is like playwriting, because the characters come out most meaningfully in the scenes. So, and you didn't have a tape recorder. Nobody had a tape recorder. So nobody was there to tell you exactly what happened in when, you know, Alex and Nikki decided to get married. I mean, they did write letters about it, both of them. But it's up to you to write a scene that you believe conveys the emotion, that the reader would have a feeling of being on fly on the wall. And so you have to be true to the way you believe they would talk without using kind of crazy old fashioned language, the way they would talk, the way they would express ideas, the way how they would bounce off each other. Also remember that humor and pathos, that's a big part of life. And, you know, these things, nothing, these, the people that were writing about, they had no idea what was coming. They're living in their moment just as we're living in ours. And so you know, there's a tension between what we know as readers and what they can't know, but you want to experience the events the way they experience them in the running time. I do think that's why it's this novel. I did write it all in the present tense because I thought there was a lot people already know about these characters, and I wanted to evoke the feeling of, but this is how it felt for them when they knew nothing about what was going to happen to them. So that was that's an artistic choice too, within the constraints of fact.
Well, this story is beautifully rendered, you take elements that we know and you give us a little glimpse behind the curtain, which I think is exactly what you want good historical fiction to do. The Romanov Brides, a novel of the last Tsarina and her sisters, is available in 2 weeks. We'll put links in the show notes where you can pre-order it from Amazon if you want, or if you have a great local bookstore, go visit them and tell them to pre-order it for you. Support local books anywhere you can. If you don't have a great local bookstore, we will put links in the show notes where you can grab it from Amazon. Claire, thank you so much for coming on the show today and catching up a little bit from the last time we chatted.
It was a great pleasure, Hank. Anytime. I'll try to write another book so we can meet again.
Please do. For people who are just discovering you and want to, dig into any news coming up, or follow along for your back catalog, is there a place online that's
yeah, best? I have a website where I write about the historical background of my books and where to read more, and I post essays I've written about the characters. It's a sort of fan site for myself of my own characters, and so please come to ClaireMcHugh.com for more information about me. And I do often speak on Zoom to classes about European history or to book clubs. So you can contact me there.
Excellent. Thank you so much for joining us today, Claire.
It was a great pleasure. Take care.
Thanks. That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.